Here, can I just note that when I went home last night, I'm going to be ready on all the schedule.
You have an announcement today?
He's biding his time. Okay, I think we are ready to get started. Commissioner Fritz is here. There she is. Let's get this work session underway. I want to thank our Planning and Sustainability Commission members who are here to work with us on this, Chair Baugh and Commissioner Schultz, and encourage everyone to read their transmittal letter to the City Council for the comp plan that we're starting. This is some of the most important work that we as a City Council will do. This blueprint for the future, the comp plan, is a critical document, but it's also at a critical time. We're experiencing all this growth and change, and there are good things about that growth that we want to take advantage of, and there are things about that growth that could erode the quality of life here. There are huge concerns about affordability and about displacement, which the Commission has expressed in the work that they've done so far and what they've sent to us, and we all hear those concerns from the community. So this is real stuff, and it's big stuff, and it's right now. And those of us who, some of us on this council might be rightly accused of wonking out on planning stuff, there was never a better time to do that because this document really matters.
I don't know why you're looking.
Sorry, Amanda, but you and I kind of represent that statement. So this work session today is to introduce the recommended comp plan draft, understand the decision-making so far, and propose some initial questions. Future work sessions will dive deeper into discrete elements of the plan like housing and economic development, environment, transportation. Today we have this work session with staff presentations. Public testimony will begin on November 19th here at the Council Chambers. I want to thank the public that's been involved in this process in addition to Susan and her staff because we've had over 4,000 comments, extensive civic involvement that's made it a better plan. So here we are. We're trying to plan a great place. They don't happen by accident. We've done a lot of good work as a city to focus on compact growth in a region that has, by and large, held the line on the urban growth boundary. And that means that we're expected to grow by about 250,000 new people and 150,000 more jobs by 2035. There's some places where I certainly see and where this process has certainly seen the opportunity for positive change and placemaking that makes Portland better. If you look at 82nd or Barber or Powell or Sandy, they're old highways dominated by traffic with low density development and not many pedestrians or bicycles. They can be better places. And then there are places that we need to defend and protect. I always say that the plan is a plan for change and a plan for avoiding change, and you do both with this. So this is a critical piece of work. Again, I want to thank our amazing volunteers who should not, I hope they don't, count the number of hours that they spend serving this city. And with that, I'll turn it over to Chair Baugh to kick us off.
Thank you, Mayor Hales. I also want to acknowledge the entire PSC for their work on this, and also Susan and her staff have just been amazing through this comp plan process. And I want to acknowledge the public. We had a lot of public, a lot of diverse public that came to us and told us what they wanted to see change, what they liked, didn't like. And so it's important that as you read the plan that you understand that the diversity and really a lot of the outcomes are from the diversity we heard from the public. I would encourage you to read each of the letters that we sent. We sent two letters. One's kind of a traditional comp plan, and one is really, as Howard says, the what is Portland, the special sauce. And it's pretty short, and I think it's entertaining, but it also talks about, you know, this plan is more than about building heights and setbacks. It's really about people, and it's about that people of special sauce that makes Portland, Portland, and we're not San Francisco, LA, or New York, or Seattle. We are Portland, and what makes us Portland. This is a once-in-a-generation opportunity to shape the future of Portland, and so I want to talk about a couple areas in particular that we heard its emphasis, and I'm sure you will hear too. One is, and I can't emphasize this enough, we have an adequate supply of land for jobs in different sectors of Portland's diverse economy, including colleges, hospitals, the new economy on the Central East Side, commercial main streets, offices in the Central City, manufacturing, distribution jobs that take advantage of the things that people like, air, water quality, and the highways and our infrastructure. You will hear a lot, we heard a lot about land supply, jobs, and opportunities. It's a significant issue. We believe the plan has that, as I said, adequate supply of land to supply the jobs. There's an investment strategy that's in the letter that we emphasize, but it's an important component. The second is the plan commits to, I think, Portland's continued commitment to protecting the air, water, quality, habitats, and natural resources, the things that people move here for, and that attract our skilled labor force and enhance our productivity. The plan will reduce the need to drive, enable shorter trips, and give people more choices. Part of the transportation plan is creating more choices and putting people where those choices are, so in our corridors, so that you don't have to take a car. You can take a bus or a train, or you can walk or ride your bike. So there's more choices. And it helps preserve our limited road capacity for those who need it most, our business community and the freight community, so that there's less cars, but there's more opportunities for freight to travel. This plan will make it possible to reduce vehicle miles traveled per year by 27% by 2035. That's a significant reduction. But those are choices that we're giving our future and current residents to take something other than a car. And it translates directly to household savings and reduces the amount of money that leaves our economy for the fossil fuel to have other investments in our economy. And that's important when you talk about affordability of housing. Transportation is a significant component of a household income, and if we can reduce that, we give people an opportunity to have more money to spend on housing and other things in Portland. The plan also recognizes that Portland has been adding people faster than housing. Over the past 5 years, the population has increased by more than 46,000, while we've only built 12,000 housing units. We have more in the pipeline, but we're just out of balance. This has put pressure on the housing market. We all know the story. It's increased housing costs. The comp plan is not a silver bullet. It does not resolve the issue, but by itself, it's not that. But it is a significant tool to help ensure adequate supply of housing for all types and that address the affordable housing. It's a critical element in that affordable housing strategy. So, you know, is this plan in front of you going to solve that problem if you do everything? I doubt it, but it takes you a long ways to the solutions, and it is, I would say, community-based solutions that you have a community of people behind that believe in those solutions. For example, adding more multifamily buildings in centers and corridors creates more options for people. I talked about that's where we're putting transportation. So there's a linkage between transportation and housing. For different stages, as you think about people in different stages, so we've got housing we looked at for young people, people working for their jobs, and then as you think about people in their later years in life, in retirement, and a broad spectrum of income levels, so from lower income to high income, how do we, and geographic choices, so it's just not concentrated in one part of the city, but it's around the city, in the central city, and in neighborhoods. Finally, Portland is great because of the thoughtful plan we've done in the past, but now we've got to look to the future. And what I see is we had a very diverse population come to us and tell us what they would like to see in the future. The plan reflects that, and the plan really meets that diverse population in the future as we think about what it looks like. I mean, today, 25% of Portlanders are a diverse population. That's double of the last time we did this in 1980, and it continues to get more diverse So we're really planning and looking into the future of that diverse population. Development of public facilities investments can increase the neighborhood of livability. We know that. We can get better access to shopping and services through walkability, better transit service. Greater demand for housing and commercial space can increase property values and the cost for residents and businesses. For many, neighborhood revitalization is positive, but for others, it's a negative experience. That's gentrification. It becomes less affordable. The negative consequences we've heard about from that. These consequences are involuntary displacement because rents go up, housing costs go up, and lower-income households can't be near their jobs. They're forced out of a neighborhood. They're forced out of the transportation choices that we're trying to provide, and they can't live near them. Those are standing issues, gentrification, displacement. The plan has policies around gentrification and displacement for affordable housing. As growth, I hope we can manage growth in a way that retains that affordability, improves access to opportunities and jobs, because we've heard from business, one of the reasons they like to come to Portland is because of the people, and the people come here for air quality, they come here for our special sauce, if you will, and that we need to think about how to preserve that and grow it. We need to preserve affordable housing. We need to preserve local businesses and increase the supply. Not only preserve it, but increase the supply of affordable housing in gentrifying neighborhoods, increase the supply of affordable business locations in gentrifying neighborhoods, and really increase a way to have people stay in their neighborhoods and new people to move into those neighborhoods in a variety of populations. Catherine, would you, have any?
You covered it very well. Thank you.
That's all.
All right, thank you. Good morning. First, I just want to thank Commissioner Baugh, Andre, and Kat for their leadership and the entire Planning and Sustainability Commission for their really unique perspectives. We have people who are doctors, who are educators, who are environmentalists, who are developers, who are architects, all on the commission. It's very broad. It's very different, really, than any other planning commission in other cities because we've brought in these broad perspectives. It's not just design and developers, and I think that's given us a much broader plan. So our goal over the next, literally, you're going to meet with us in these workshops 4 or 5 times, and then you're going to have a pile of hearings. You get to have all the fun that the Planning and Sustainability Commission already had. Our goal is to be concise in our presentations, answer the questions we can right here, get back to you on other issues that we need to get back to you on. So this morning with me are Eric Engstrom and Tom Armstrong and Michelle Kudyk-North, who will join us a little bit later. We're going to describe all of the components of the plan, the growth scenarios, the citywide system plan. Before we jump in, I want you to just take a step back for some perspective just for a second. You'll remember that, and it's in your packet here, we're going to kind of start walking through this first little diagram here with the blue. Go back to the Portland plan. It provided us sort of an overall guidance vision for the city. It provided us with goals, with strategies, and 12 very specific measures of success. Past city councils and some of you came up with those 12 measures. We started with 200 and something, I think, and came down to those as being the important measures. The comprehensive plan kind of falls out of that. So it becomes, it's the specific policies, the rules, and the zoning map that help to reach those specific measures of success. And then there's specific plans that fall out of that, which are area plans, corridor plans, the central city plan, climate action plan, all of those things kind of fall out. So it's very much one building upon the other. In terms of what it is we're actually doing, the comprehensive plan is a statewide, it's mandated plan. It's for long-term and long-range land use planning, and it is a public facility investment plan. The purpose of the plan is to guide the future growth and development of the city. And as the mayor said, you know, good places don't just happen by accident. Lots and lots of cities don't do this kind of a comprehensive plan the way we do, and the growth still comes. And so the plan doesn't cause the growth. The growth is coming, and this gives us an opportunity to get ready and prepared for it. The goals and policies within the comprehensive plan are designed to help meet Portland's high-level goals and measures of success that are in the Portland plan. It's to help us become healthy, more prosperous, more equitable, and a more resilient city. From my perspective, the most important point is this is not just about urban design. The urban design strategy is awesome in here. This plan is about people. It's about finding new tools, both land use tools, financial tools, in service to people to help provide jobs, to help provide affordable housing, to help provide a quality environment. So the goals and policies that are in the plan, they cover a wide variety of topics. They're all there to inform and guide the land use decisions. The land use decisions are all of those things that you often deal with on an everyday basis around the zoning map, around public facilities, things like the transportation system plan. What's really important, and I also know you know this, is that the comprehensive plan is a broad document with many different policies. And while it lays out all of those policies, and in some ways in a very bold manner, it does not make the decisions. It lays out what the guidance is, and you at City Council are the ones that are balancing environmental and social and housing and affordability and different goals. So it gives direction. And I just think that's super important because a lot of times you have a choice. And this is kind of my last, you know, bit of direction here in terms of not technical details is you have a choice to have a bold vision for the city or kind of lowest common denominator. And some of the policies in here, when you look at them side by side, they seem in conflict, and they are. And I think it's important for you all to look at how do we put the policies in there that will help to prioritize equity, that will help to build more affordable housing, that will help us have the transportation system we want. You can't go too far out. If they're too far in conflict, you're not going to get the plan done. But that there is this opportunity to put the things that you really want the city to be in the plan. Back to some of the details, the comprehensive plan is very much built on this foundation of the Portland plan, but very much built on the 1980 comprehensive plan that has served the city so well for 35 years. And, you know, it continues the success of connecting land use and transportation. It continues the success of building walkable, transit-friendly neighborhoods. And so those measures of success, I won't go through them all. They're in here. You've known them, and they've actually become, in many ways, some of our budget documents. It's things like having 80% of households live in our complete neighborhoods, reducing carbon emissions by 50%. Helping 90% of households actually become economically self-sufficient. And then there's issues around health, helping 84% of eighth graders reach a healthy weight. And that's not something you usually find in a comp plan, but we found very much that the connections between education and health are very much based often in a city's actual physical layout and land use. And then finally, having a goal to have 70% of people be able to walk or bike or take transit to work. So the comp plan is only one tool. Obviously, private investment is the biggest engine that moves all of this. Public investment, technical assistance, financial tools, other regulatory tools that we have. But the comp plan, as Andre mentioned, is absolutely a major player in helping us to succeed. The last item I want to review before handing it over to Eric is what are these complete neighborhoods that we all talk about 15 or 20 years ago? I think they were kind of theoretical in a lot of ways. We had a few in certain parts of the city just beginning to develop now. Many, many parts of the city really have become complete neighborhoods. More than 60% of residents in Portland now have access within 20 minutes to the kinds of services and grocery stores and parks and schools and the things that they want on an everyday basis. The goal is to move towards 80%. 20% doesn't seem like a lot, but that's about 200,000 people over the next 20 years. So it's significant. It changes the way people are able to get around over the next 20 years. It changes the way, hopefully, of affordability over the next 20 years. I'm not sure where this map is, but maybe it's in the back. There's
page
6. That just lists in a very black and purple way, not black and white, but the black areas are all of the complete neighborhoods, and the purple are ones that are less than complete for one reason or another. So if we want to create the opportunity for more people to live in complete neighborhoods, it's really kind of two ways. One, we can direct more growth into the neighborhoods that already have all those services, or in the purple areas, we can provide more infrastructure and services so that those neighborhoods and those people that live there have the opportunity to take advantage of those things. I'm going to list my top 6 reasons for why we need to continue to have complete neighborhoods, starting with we kind of have to. We can't move out. We're a landlocked city. We've got city all around us, other cities there. Second, we could move the urban growth boundary, but that would have huge impacts on farms, on forests, natural areas. It would increase the need to travel. It would increase congestion. It would increase carbon emissions. Third, if we don't create these neighborhoods and we limit the supply of housing, we will further increase the cost of housing. This is the San Francisco model, you know, supply and demand. It's very basic. It will make it even less affordable for families who are trying to move here. And the fourth reason is complete neighborhoods help to provide a variety of housing choices. It gives us an opportunity to have everything from apartments to row houses along our corridors, and it allows us to protect our single-family neighborhoods by putting most of the growth, more than 40% of the growth in this plan, is along the centers and corridors and not in our single-family neighborhoods. Having services and stores nearby allows people to bike and walk and take the bus. It reduces the number of cars on the road. And so this is very much a business-oriented plan. By getting people off the road for their everyday lives, it's good for business. It makes more room for freight and trucks. And finally, it makes it easier for people to get more exercise. And we all know the health costs are just such a huge part of the burden in our economy, and less pollution from cars and trucks. So I'm going to wrap up and hand it over to Eric. Tom's going to later talk through kind of some of the growth scenarios that we've developed over the past 3 years. We've had lots of national, international attention on how we've done the growth scenarios. So technically, these are really well done, looking at where's growth coming from, where do we think. Again, it's more than a crystal ball. It's not an exact science, but we think we know where and how much growth is going to be coming. You're going to hear a lot as you go through the hearings about particular properties, about particular zoning issues in people's backyards. And that's going to be super important and something you need to pay attention to. But you do have this opportunity now. This is sort of like once in 20 years to take and look at the big picture and look at housing and equity and jobs and the environment and how you're going to balance those things. So I'll turn it over to Eric, and he's going to walk you through some of the technical details. We also, I believe, Catherine is here. So we have city attorney here also. There she is. To help us with any specific legal questions you have.
Thank you, Susan. I'm just going to take a moment to ground you in what we've given you for the comp plan. It has several components, and many of those are on the table. The first component is, the policy document to your right or to your left with the brown circle cover includes both policy statements that guide land use decisions in the future, but also a vision statement and something we call guiding principles, which I'll talk about in a minute. That sets really the stage for what we aspire to be over the next 20 years. The goals and policies provide direction. The comp plan map is another significant deliverable that's on the table in front of you. That spatially defines where we want desired land uses. It also includes what our urban services boundary is and the recognized boundaries of specific defined places like town centers and neighborhood centers. I want to just take a moment to remind you that the zoning map and the comp plan map are different things. And the comp plan map is the long-term 20-year vision. The zoning map is what you look at when you go to the permit center today and you need to know what's allowed currently. And a lot of times those are the same, but sometimes they're different because we have aspirations that go beyond what we can do immediately. And so this is the long-range map we're looking at. The other element is the public facilities plan, which Michelle Kunick will talk about in more detail. It's this document. It provides a list of needed facilities to serve these land uses over the next 20 years. It's not the complete list of projects, but it is the projects that are growth related and related to serving that land use. Finally, the transportation system plan is a component of the comp plan. It is in this first iteration, it lives in a couple places. It lives in Chapter 9 and Chapter 8 of the policy document, which talk about public facilities and transportation. It also lives in the list of significant projects, which we've given you. There's a component of that, which is the transportation investment list. There's more elements of the transportation system plan coming in the future, but that's the first piece of that. So that's really what you're holding the hearings about this fall, are those deliverables. Figure 1 on page 7 of your handout gives you kind of a roadmap of what the comp plan is and isn't, and what the relationship of the different parts are. It's implemented, as Susan mentioned, through a variety of tools, including probably most significantly the zoning code and zoning map, but also service agreements with urban providers like transit and other sewer and water districts. Urban renewal plans are framed around the comp plan. It governs annexations, where we intend to annex and where we don't intend to annex. And then it can affect some development agreements, though not all of them. So that's the range of implementing tools. And I want to stress, this is very important, that the comp plan is, unlike the Portland plan, not a set of policies about everything you do as a city. It is about land use and infrastructure and development and the physical form of the city, although it is very broad.
Eric, can I ask you a question about figure 1.-1?
Mm-hmm.
In the middle of it, under supporting documents, under public facilities plan, you break out sewer, stormwater, and water.
Mm-hmm.
Where is watershed? Does that reside under natural resource inventory?
It shows up there, but it also shows up within the sewer. That's a little bit of an outdated statement. That is stormwater as well, and those two things cover watershed planning. If you look at the CSP document, there's quite a bit about watershed planning in that section.
Most everyone in Portland lives within one of five watersheds, and I'm not raising this just because Mike Haukel sent me an email. I'm just raising it. I'm raising it because we do think of ourselves as the water, sewer, stormwater, watershed utilities, and I think I would appreciate if we could call that out just so it's not implied somewhere else.
And there is a map of those watersheds in the policy document. Susan mentioned this is a state requirement. Oregon's had a statewide planning program since 1973, and that's based on 19 statewide goals. And we're responsible as a city to maintain a comprehensive plan that's in compliance with those 19 goals. Periodically, the state requires us to update our plan, and that's appropriately called periodic review. And in 2007, we entered periodic review. We got a letter from the state saying you must now work on your plan. You adopted in 2010 a work plan for that process. That work plan has five tasks. The first task was developing a public involvement plan for the exercise. You approved that, I believe, in 2011. Second task was a series of background documents. The council adopted that set of background documents in 2012. That includes an economic opportunities analysis, buildable land supply, a natural resources inventory, citywide system plan, public infrastructure assessment reports. Those all went to the state and were acknowledged, with the exception of the economic opportunities report, which we pulled back in the aftermath of the port's decision to not annex West Hayden Island. And you'll see a revised EOA coming forward with this package. So that was task two. Task three and four is the meat of what you're receiving this fall. That's the alternatives analysis and the actual plan. So that includes the documents I mentioned before. The final task, which you don't yet have, but is before Planning and Sustainability Commission right now, are the implementing measures amendments to the zoning map and zoning code to implement this plan. And it's not a complete rewrite of those tools, but it is a strategic update of parts of those tools to make sure that they're not in conflict with the new plan and that they're optimized to be able to move forward. So those implementing measures, again, amendments to the zoning code and zoning maps, are moving forward into the Planning Commission now while you review the larger policies. You should receive those plans then starting by mid-2016. But before you right now are the higher-level policies and the bigger picture land use map. I want to say a little bit about, before I leave that topic, one other thing to note is that after you adopt a comprehensive plan, it goes to the state for their acknowledgement, and there's a 6 to 9 month period where they determine whether it meets state planning goals, and there is an opportunity for objections and appeals at that point. So if you were to adopt a comprehensive plan by early 2016, it would probably be, our best estimate would be around July 2017 before it would be in effect. And so we'll likely write an effective date into this action that accounts for that process at the state level. And that's just something to be aware of, because you'll have a lot of people who want it to go into effect now or want it to delay, and who benefit from both sides. And that time delay will become more and more relevant as we go into that period. I want to mention the guiding principles again. In your packet, you have in one of the pockets the introduction to the plan. It's kind of the Reader's Digest version of the plan. And in the beginning of that, on page I-7 and I-6, there's a vision statement on the left side and some guiding principles on the right-hand side. And those are really the high-level goals, mirroring the Portland plan's high-level messages. This is intended to be a vision statement that guides your interpretation. There are hundreds of policies in the document, and you can weave a lot of different stories by looking at different policies, but the intent of the guiding principles is to step back and say, these are the big picture pieces that are really important, and these policies carry these big principles out. The comp plan is not a rule book, and even the strongest policies don't automatically trump other policies. There's a balancing process. As you know, when you consider land use decisions, you reach an on-balance decision with the facts at hand, site-specific facts or situational-specific facts. And this comp plan does not resolve all of those possible conflicts. It gives you a suite of policies to consider, and these guiding principles are intended to give some aim to those policies, but not determine the outcome. So you will still have to decide what's right based on the facts at hand and the situation in front of you. You will receive testimony about the relative strengths of different policies. We talked a lot about the verbs in the Planning and Sustainability Commission. Verbs do have meaning. There are strong verbs and weak verbs. But just remember that it is an on-balance thing, and it's not that you have to check every box. You reach an on-balance decision. It's important to think about that as you weigh the language and the policies. I think that concludes my just opening statements. And I think we didn't mention this before, but the structure of this work session, we're going to stop three times and have open discussion, and this is the first of those three breaks. After this break, we'll go on to talk more about the growth strategy itself and the demographic and economic changes that are driving it, and then we'll talk about the public infrastructure at the last part. But this is an opportunity for open discussion of what is the comp plan supposed to be about, what are the broad themes, and what have we given you?
I have a question about that last thing about the guiding principles, and I'm pleased that the first goals and policies isn't on community involvement. I'm wondering, though, why community involvement isn't listed under the guiding principles.
It's probably embodied within the equity principle most thoroughly, and in that a lot of equity has to do with people being involved in process that affects them. So I would say it's core to the equity principle.
Sort of a philosophical question, which is, strikes me there's a sort of an irony here in that the criticism we often hear from the public about our code, for example, is it's getting big and cumbersome, and it's very hard for ground-level planners to reconcile things that are sometimes at odds. And that's the genesis of RECAP and all the reform efforts. And yet, I think one of the great exercises we do as a council is we come together on land use hearings and we try to reconcile competing values, and we have these debates. And I think people generally are surprised at how transparent that is and how robust the discussion is and how unpredictable it is. How do you balance the need to have a vision document that we interpret that's broad and has things that are sometimes competing with the need on the ground to have code that's easy to follow and predictable?
Part of what we try to do is to provide enough factual basis so that you're able to help make good decisions. So Tom will talk a little bit more in a minute about, you know, how many jobs do we really think are going to come here? What kind of jobs? Who's going to move here? Who's here now? Who's going to be living in what areas of the city? And so we try to provide the best factual basis we can so that you're able to make a lot of those decisions. We try whenever possible to make the rules as simple as possible. But what happens often and rather quickly is there are these competing goals, and we come to council and we have an issue, whether it's around, you know, a zoning issue or trees, dare I say, and people have different perspectives. And so we're always going to get broader and thinner. And I think the history of planning in communities is that there's sort of this waves that happen where councils go out and out and try to include everything in, and then there's sort of this desire to, no, let's make it very specific. You know, these are the rules, and you're going to follow the rules, and if you come to the counter, you know, these are the 142 rules you're going to follow. And then pretty soon people get frustrated with that, and it starts going out. So I think it's a real ebb and flow over time.
Flexibility is certainly a true word to do a lot in the testimony. Those land use systems really
designed to do both simultaneously. You want to have clear and objective and simple codes that embody what you're trying to do, but you want to have a path to get an exception and do something different. And it's especially that second path that these policies are about.
So let me raise another big global topic, and you've talked about it, and maybe also get our commission leadership to reflect on this a little bit as well. You know, we think about the growth pressures all the time, and we see how popular Portland is as a destination for people to move or bring businesses here. Joe Courtright finally put it a different way the other day in a discussion with my business roundtable. He said the United States has a city shortage, which means, of course, we have a shortage of walkable urban places because that's what the market is demanding. And so you've set a goal in the plan. We're going to have 12,500 people a year for the next 20 years arriving here. You've set a goal in the plan of improving the number of neighborhoods that meet our walkable urban standards. That's good. I think we all would agree that's a good direction to go. But we also have past practice or errors of omission to correct, right? We annexed East Portland. It has, you know, dozens of miles of unbuilt streets, a poorly connected grid. Southwest has some of the same issues on a different scale with the added issues of stormwater, making that even more complex. Some would say that we are going to have that few cities have succeeded in urbanizing suburbia, particularly since people live there and they have opinions about their neighborhood too. It's harder to urbanize suburbia than it is to urbanize an old rail yard. How aggressive have you been in that reshaping agenda, both as a way to accommodate growth and as a way to ameliorate the shortcomings of the planning that's occurred in places like East Portland in the past? Where are we on that? You say, but this could be a bold plan or it could be a hold-the-line plan. Where would you put us on that measure, given the draft that you're bringing to us?
One thing I think to mention on that is you have we've recommended that you have to do a little bit of both. It's effective to plan and locate growth in places where you already have infrastructure, obviously, and that's this idea of the complete neighborhood map and locating people where there are existing cities, as you know, in or urban places that are walkable. We've set a goal of having 80% of our population be able to live in a place like that by 2035, and just from a math perspective, you can't do that by just putting people all in the downtown or all in the Pearl District. You have to improve other neighborhoods outside the city center and outside the innermost neighborhoods. And so it's a mix of both. There's a dual investment strategy recommended where we have to make more complete neighborhoods, but we also have to put as much growth as possible in existing complete neighborhoods.
And I think it comes down to, and this will be the details that we can work out individually when we're chatting with each of you, when you have your questions, is looking at the actual list of projects, the investments that are planned over the next 20 years, and looking at where are those projects. Which, you know, because we had this discussion with the commission for months, and there was a shift over time to ensure that there were investments in East Portland, that there were investments in places that are not complete neighborhoods right now, because that was really important, both from making sure that we actually meet the goals, but also from an equity perspective. So I think it really does come down to looking at the list of projects in terms of infrastructure.
The purple on this map essentially embodies the places where we are making infrastructure investment to improve that completeness. And so that's the delta. Right. It's not, as you said, not all Portland neighborhoods are the right places for growth. And so there's still a lot of gray on that map that are places where much is going to remain the same.
I think you just covered it there, but I was just going to add, it goes back to the centers and corridors and focusing some energy and a lot of energy there so that you can let the neighborhoods around those centers and corridors be those neighborhoods and still have the character that those neighborhoods have. But yes, there's going to be tension and growth in how those corridors change.
That's at this juncture.
Could you clarify just what's the difference between a center and a corridor?
Sure. They both have mixed-use zoning and allow urban development. The suite of policies around a center is really to... A center is a place where that's taken up a little bit up a notch, where there's a stronger concentration of services, things like grocery stores and amenities that you need to be able in your daily life. So we're not going to, there's not enough growth in the next 20 years for us to create that sense of completeness along the 150 miles of corridors that we have in the city. So the center's strategy is to try and identify specific locations on corridors where there may be enough critical mass. And often these are existing places like Hollywood or Montevilla, where we can focus growth and have that critical mass to maintain those services, again, because we can't do that along the 150-some miles of corridors that we have.
And so it still includes the town centers that we've always talked about, like Hillsdale and other places. Okay.
I'll get into a little bit more in the second part of the presentation about the names.
Mayor Hales, if I may, I wanted to
keep us on.
We have been working with the planning staff and with the commission over the course of their development of the draft plan and review. And I wanted to share with you sort of two thoughts that we have offered to them and that have guided our review of the plan. And they echo things that Eric has said to you. First, that our starting point was state law in its definition of what a comprehensive plan is. And it defines a comp plan as a generalized coordinated land use map and policy statement that interrelates all functional and natural systems and activities relating to the use of lands. So the linchpin of a comprehensive plan is it's focused on land and the way land is used. In this sense, we think the comprehensive plan is best viewed as one way to implement the Portland plan, and particularly those elements that pertain to, that are best reflected in land use policies and programs. The city has many other policies and programs and activities that implement other elements of the Portland Plan. And we certainly understand that the universe of factors that affect land use has evolved since the state's land use planning program was first adopted. And the Planning and Sustainability Commission has made its judgment about how broad or narrow that should be, and you too will be reviewing that and deciding how broad or narrow that should be. The one cautionary note we offered is that the more land use topics you address, or the more non-land use topics you address in the comprehensive plan, the greater the risk that programmatic, budgetary, and other decisions to implement these policies may be open to legal challenge as land use decisions in the future. Not saying you can't do that, it's simply be careful about what you're doing and be thoughtful about what you're doing as you in whatever scope or breadth you want the comprehensive plan to incorporate. Our second caution was an obvious one that Eric mentioned, which is language matters. There's a very extensive glossary attached to the comprehensive plan. It defines some 35 verbs, some as mandatory, some as more aspirational, some as something in between. But the words you use in the comprehensive plan are important in just determining whether the function of a goal or policy is to guide future planning efforts, to guide the development of future code language, or the approval or denial of a specific land use application. It will determine whether a policy expresses a mandatory requirement or expresses an aspirational or directional principle. Again, you can decide what you want it to do. It's simply be clear about the language you use and the intended function associated with that. One other note is that the draft comprehensive plan refers to other documents, inventories, and studies. Some we're required to refer to, like our CSP, our TSP, and other supporting documents. But how they're described will determine whether they're incorporated as part of the comprehensive plan, whether they'll serve as implementing measures, whether they'll guide future planning efforts, or serve as support documents. Again, in some cases, we encourage you to consider whether it's necessary to refer to all of these documents. If you do, doing so may allow some actions implementing or described in these documents to be challenged as future land use decisions. It's up to you to decide whether that's that is a risk you want to take, but that was simply a cautionary note to pay attention to as you review the plan. Like you, we want this updated plan to serve the city as very well for the next 20 years, and our goal has been to help work with, is to work with you to make sure that happens.
It's good you raised this issue because obviously the plan affects all bureaus. So that's we ought to delve into this just a bit to understand maybe where the risk threshold is.
I want to mention a couple of things, and that's how I read it, because I listened to the kickoff, and I think aspirational land use balancing all makes sense. My concerns are when I feel it gets a little outside of that boundary, and it's really contextual because we've already talked about the verbs. Prohibit, require, ensure, it's hard to balance those. If something's prohibited, how do you balance it? And Tom has mentioned, I've gone back and looked at some of those. My concern is you get into a discussion or raise public expectations in a way that comes back and requires lots of effort on your part, which I think is easily handled. The second comment is, again, back to public expectations and maybe unintended consequences. What I see is maybe getting beyond the land use plan or something like open data, which I think is a big issue. I'm not sure it's a land use issue. And I see community benefits agreements tied in. Well, that can mean different things. It's a huge political issue. I don't know if it's a land use issue. And I worry that, and I guess another one, plans and investments can sound like a budgetary item. And I know the glossary addresses that some. But if the public has the sense that all those are sort of fair game to deal with in the context of the plan, you get into the other issue of does this then go to DLCD or LUBA when you wouldn't expect it to? Because the more we get under the land use umbrella, the more susceptible to that other path. And so if we're worrying about it from city bureaus, you don't want to see someone hung up if they're dealing with something like body cams. Well, that's open data. The default position is everything's available. You get into discussions, I think, that you don't really want to invite. And so that my concern is those things that get beyond land use. And as you look at this, I think you just have to make that decision. Because as you suggest, you open yourself up for a different avenue of protest and appeal.
Fred, how do we get this feedback from legal, for example, as we go through this process? It seems to me it raises a couple of interesting questions. One is, we don't want to necessarily have a robust public discussion about the legal options to challenge our actions before LUBA. So, I mean, we're going to do a risk assessment and say, boy, this is particularly vulnerable. I mean, that's not our nature when we talk about legal issues. But at the other, we don't want you sitting over here with a red flag just all day long, throwing it out, and the mayor saying, why'd you throw that red flag? I think we crossed the line or closed the line. So how do we get the benefit of your concern about where the line is and what side we should be on as we deliberate through this and not have that sort of dominate the proceedings?
The quick answer from my perspective is we've arm wrestled a lot. And part of it is the areas that, some of these areas like housing, affordability, energy use, 20 years ago we would have said absolutely they do not belong in a comprehensive plan. That has nothing to do with land use. And now we all think they do. And so things evolve over time, and I think that was the open data issue. And absolutely there will be things on the edge that like, well, that's open data. Everything's open data because in the next 10 years all the work we do in every sector is going to have an open data component. And so there is a risk there. The balancing part really is there is a risk in anything you put in here that it could be appealed, but that's also kind of the benefit. That's why we put it in there, to really hold ourselves accountable. That's why we have a statewide land use planning process. And so sometimes you actually do want things that are on the margin to be in the land use plan, because exactly that reason, you want to be held accountable for it. And so this is where we kind of do this all the time. And I think having conversations about this during the work sessions about areas that you think are on that line, we should just talk about them clearly and try to make those as often as possible not be require or prohibit, but more likely, because these are still evolving areas, be in those more mushy middle words, the verbs. So that's my recommendation.
Did you discuss having a volume one land use and a volume two everything else?
That was a little bit what the Portland plan serves as, is the bigger picture, everything you do, and the land use is the comp plan is intended to be that we did it the other way around, volume one being everything, volume two being the comp plan and what it's about in growth and land use.
Catherine, and I would like a private briefing on the things that you and Susan have arm wrestled about.
You arm wrestle here in public.
Well, I would like something like that too. I mean, I think you're identifying issues that you're saying, both of you are saying, we should be approached with care, and I don't think we're going to necessarily identify those left to our own devices. We need to hear what it is you've raised. What are the areas that you're concerned about? And if that's a attorney-client memo to us or something like that, that's fine. But
we'll be happy to do that in whatever fashion you like. Okay. And some of the solutions may be simply massaging the language, making something that's raised in a mandatory term in a softer term.
We might be able to have a legal risk briefing for the whole council under our privilege, rather than you having to do that five times.
That's fine.
I would just like to add, we had long discussions about the verbs of prohibit and limit and things, but part of that discussion was out of this concept of equity and inclusion. So when you talk about whether it's community benefits or housing, you look at the policies around housing and anti-displacement, you look at transportation, part of that diversity of the population that came to us, and this is the evolution, when you look down to 2035, you're hearing a different population and a different viewpoint, and part of that is incorporated here. It the plan legally, I'm sure, and we heard from the city attorney, you don't want to do this or do that, but if you look beyond that and say, how do you include people of a diverse population and ensure they have prosperity and opportunities to live and work in our city, some things you kind of say, well, we can't do that or we shouldn't be doing that, and that's an evolution, and that's kind of a risk, and it really is, to me, a balance, but it was a risk, and we had long discussions. You will have those long discussions about those verbs, and Catherine was great in giving us some very good advice about those verbs, but at the end of the day, we kind of said on some issues, it's a risk today as we look at it. 10 years from now, maybe standard language. And I just would put that in as a perspective of keep in mind the population coming in to talk to you.
We can move on maybe now to the next section. And on that, I'd say we were about 80-20 risk averse. We were only risky maybe 20% of the time. And most of the time, Catherine works out more than I do, and so she won. So, and that was good. I think that was good. We're going to talk now about growth management. What kind of growth do we think is going to come here? And what kind of growth is most likely? Remember, these numbers, sometimes you get into talking about these numbers, and you'll say, well, the goal is to have, 250,000 more people move here. It's not a goal. This is our best estimate. It's not the plan causing the growth. This is our best estimate of the growth, given both the demand and the market realities and the research that we've done. So I'll hand it over to Tom Armstrong.
Okay, so I'll give you today just a high-level overview of some of the recent trends we've seen that help inform our sort of growth management strategy as well as the growth forecast. We have two additional sessions to dig deeper into both the housing and the jobs forecast. But, as was mentioned earlier, the state basically requires that our comp plan accommodate 20 years of growth and that we show how we do that. We coordinate that growth forecast with Metro and the rest of the region and how that Metro manages the urban growth boundary and how much they allocate to Portland versus the rest of the region versus new areas on the edge. And we're basing all of this off of Metro's the growth forecast that they adopted in 2012, which looks, given all of the differences of how they do their forecasting and the influence of the Great Recession, looks a lot like what they're about to adopt in 2015. So, we think this is a pretty good estimate. As was mentioned before, it's about 123,000 new households and 142,000 jobs. Some people think that's a pretty aggressive forecast, pretty on the high side. Particularly in terms of jobs, but also in terms of households. We will note, and there's a graph on page 11 of your packet, that when we go back and look at how the population trends growth in Portland has been since 2000, and we run that growth projection out to 2035, we are matching pretty well on that growth trend line that will get us there. And so we think it's a reasonable expectation for the demand that will be here in terms of, two-thirds of that demand is going to be people moving here and wanting to be in Portland and the Portland region. I will also note, and this has come up in our Metro discussions, back in 1994, we sort of had this discussion about how much growth can Portland really accommodate. And back then, the city committed to almost 71,000 new households by 2017. Right. And I will say we are on track to meet that a year early in 2016. To fully meet that growth forecast. So I think when you look long range and when you look big picture, Metro and their forecasts are pretty accurate. we've done a pretty good job of sort of focusing and implementing our plans.